New polls show a majority of people in Scotland and Northern Ireland favor breakup of the UK as the Scottish Nationalists announce plans for a new independence referendum. A U.S. aircraft carrier group enters the South China Sea hours after Washington reaffirms its support for Taiwan in the row with China. The UN Refugee Agency says the recent tribal clashes in Sudan's Darfur region have killed at least 250 people and displaced 100,000 more. Great pleasure to have you with us. Starting with our top story, new polls indicating a majority of people in Scotland and Northern Ireland are seeking independence from the UK. Surveys in Scotland, Northern Ireland, England, and Wales also indicate that a sense of British identity is disintegrating. Meanwhile, the Scottish National Party has announced it will hold a second independence referendum if British Prime Minister Boris Johnson refuses to allow one. Scotland held a referendum in 2014 in which more than 55% of the people said no to secession from the UK. London argues that holding a second vote is against the Constitution. Let's get some more information on that. So from London, I'm joined by Robert Carter, a correspondent. Good to have you with us, Rob. So tell us about what's been responsible for this sense that I just mentioned in our news intro, this sense of the loss of British identity in the countries around the UK.
Each country within the UK is seeing a rise in anti-union sentiment, and of course they all have their own independent reasons for feeling in such a way. Scotland, of course, is unique in the sense that it has had a very large pro-independence movement for quite some time. And obviously, I'm sure you all remember the referendum of 2014, which the independence movement lost very narrowly. It was about 55% pro-union, which just about won out compared to about 45%. So obviously, it was a very close tie. But what's changed since then is obviously Brexit, and of course Scotland voted overwhelmingly to remain in the European Union. So what the Scottish Nationalist Party is arguing is that the circumstances have changed so dramatically that of course it's warranted another referendum, but Westminster of course doesn't want to give them the chance to do so. There is of course growing sentiment in Ireland as well to have a referendum on reunification, and again the north of Ireland seems to have lost out quite badly as a result of Brexit, and Wales for the first time in its history has seen an unprecedented growth in pro-independence political thinking, and the pro-independence Welsh parties have also gained in popularity. But it will be the May election coming up this year in Scotland which will be the kind of the proof, if you like, that whether or not the independence movement is popular enough to warrant a second referendum, and will certainly apply more pressure on Westminster to give in to the SNP's demands.
Mm-hmm. Now, Rob, London is saying that holding a second referendum is unconstitutional. Is there any other way, I mean, for London to be able, I mean, to give up this idea and do something, or the only way for the Scots is to hold another referendum?
Well, when you talk about legality, obviously, according to the traditional constitution here, Westminster does have to okay a referendum for it to be legal. What the SNP are aiming to do would be to hold basically an illegal referendum, but then it would force Westminster to pursue it in the courts, which would give Scotland a fighting chance to, you know, create some kind of unprecedented judicial ruling in their favour. Of course, it's a large gamble, because as we saw in Spain with the Catalonia crisis, illegal illegal referendums create constitutional crises and can also damage the legitimacy of the independence movement themselves. It's unlikely that things will deteriorate as badly here as they did in Spain with Catalonia, but certainly Scotland is looking at all means possible to pressurize Westminster. And if the pressure continues to build, how much longer can Westminster hold off on a referendum? But what the SNP are trying to do is keep it in the debate as much as possible and certainly keep Westminster under significant pressure.
Okay, thank you very much for that explanation. Robert Carter, a correspondent in London. Now, people in Portugal are heading for the polls to cast their ballots in the presidential election, which incumbent Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa has been tipped to win. 11 million people are eligible to vote, although pollsters expecting record-high abstentions due to the COVID pandemic. Most opinion polls put Rebelo de Sousa far ahead of his challengers, socialist Ana Gomes, and far-right populist Andre Ventura. Low turnout could upset the expected easy win for him. In his final campaign speech, de Sousa said that the people should not allow the election to stretch out, urging them to turn out in large numbers to back and win another term and avoid a runoff. Now, Portugal has registered new records in its daily coronavirus infections and deaths. The European country reported 15,000 new cases and 274 deaths on Saturday. Overall, it has confirmed 625,000 cases and 10,000 deaths. Portugal has one of the world's highest infection rates, which has put its health system under increasing strain. Meantime, Germany has reported 16,000 new COVID-19 infections and 879 related deaths. According to the Robert Koch Institute, over 2.1 million cases have been confirmed. The death toll in Germany now standing at around 52,000. The country has been under lockdown since mid-December. The curbs have been extended until mid-February. In the UK, the government has extended a gap between the first and second Pfizer and BioNTech vaccines up to 12 weeks to give more of its citizens a first dose.
Well, the government's following the very clear advice by the MRSA, our own experts, and from the four chief medical officers of all parts of the United Kingdom. And they said that ensuring that someone is vaccinated for the second jab within 12 weeks is fine, and that's what we're following. And as a result of that, we're ensuring that millions more people can get the first jab and the high level of protection that that provides as quickly as possible.
Senior doctors have challenged the government's decision. They say it is at odds with guidance from the World Health Organization. Britain reported 1,300 deaths from COVID-19 and 33,000 new cases on Saturday. That takes the death toll there above 97,000, the overall infections topping 1.6 million. Britain has the highest death toll in Europe, followed by Italy. The Italian health minister recorded 488 fatalities and more than 13,000 new cases in a day. Italy has registered 85,000 deaths and 2.5 million cases since the beginning of the pandemic. Time now for the news review of news statements. Russia is accusing the U.S. Embassy in Moscow of promoting the Saturday protests across the country over the detention of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova says that the embassy has published routes of planned demonstrations in support of Navalny. She demanded an explanation from American diplomats. Moscow and other cities have seen public protests against the detention. Police clashed with demonstrators who defied a ban on holding rallies in some cities in the Far East and Siberia regions. They urged the Russian government to release Navalny. A monitoring group says over 2,500 people were arrested during the rallies. Last week, Navalny was detained at an airport in Moscow upon arrival from Germany. Let's get some more information inside. So joining me will be a couple of guests, our correspondent Marina Kartanova in Moscow, and Kenneth Farrow, lecturer with Coventry University. in London. Welcome to the show. Over to Moscow first. Marina, tell us some more about what's going on there.
The U.S. Embassy in Moscow posted detailed information on its website regarding the time and locations of the planned and authorized mass rallies, which took place yesterday in Russian cities. And Russian Minister of Foreign Affairs made a statement that such comprehensive information goes beyond the concern about the well-being of U.S. citizens in Russia. This is in line with Washington's provocative and dogmatic policy of encouraging protests in countries whose governments are seen by the United States as undesirable. Any attempts to provide such coverage regarding unauthorized rallies will be deemed as blatant interference in our country's domestic affairs, and it will provoke an appropriate response. Foreign Ministry spokesman told that yesterday the U.S. Embassy in Moscow published the protest routes in Russian cities and injected the information about a march on the Kremlin. What was that, a setup or an instruction? Even the organizers had not announced these plans, she said. The U.S. diplomats will have to provide explanations in the Russian Foreign Ministry. And Zakharova noted that it can be imagined what could have happened if Russia's embassy in Washington had published a map of protest routes with destinations, for example, at the capital. This kind of orienteering should have ended up with a global hysteria of American politicians, including Russophobic slogans, and the threats of sanctions and the expulsion of Russian diplomats. So thousands in major cities of Russia yesterday joined protest in support of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny, with some scuffle and detentions taking place. And as you know, Alexei Navalny is a Russian opposition leader who heads the Anti-Corruption Foundation. He films a lot of investigations, and two of the latter caused the greatest resonance in Russian society. One of them was connected with his persecution and the chain of actions of the Russian authorities to poison him, and the last one released 4 days ago and gaining, by this moment, 77.5 million views, is connected with the construction of the palace of President Putin by the Black Sea and the history of the biggest bribe about the corruption schemes of the state authorities in Russia. These and longer growing dissatisfaction with the domestic policy of the authorities in the country served as a trigger for yesterday's events, throughout the country. Kremlin excoriates Navalny's expose of Putin's palace as a huge myth, and the files that the report contains are fake, that aims to attract a large number of viewers. The spokesman declined to discuss and explain to the nation the possible owner of the palace, as well as to talk about protests and investigation. The opposition figure and his associates began calling for Saturday protest after he was placed under 30-day custody, and authorities have tried to stem calls to join the protest on social media on grounds of illegal involvement of minors in protest activity and coronavirus violations. So the largest protests took place in Novosibirsk, the capital of Siberia, Moscow, and St. Petersburg, the president's hometown. Thus, its citizens expressed their attitude to what is happening. It must be also understood this is not Navalny the main reason of protests or exclusively Western puppeties as desired by the official authorities and about the Kremlin propagandists. Okay. This is the result of the socio-economic policy of the authorities, and it can be expected more in the summer. So the West is behind all the demonstrations, and the U.S. Embassy published the plan of the demonstrators, so there is coordination.
Thank you for that. Let me move to London to Professor Farrow, and let's see how he looks at the situation. Professor, what's your assessment of the situation? And this is not the first time that the U.S. is making comments, and as Moscow is calling it, interfering in its internal affairs. He's an opposition figure. It's a domestic affair, Moscow is saying. And this is what the U.S. Embassy has done. You know, the routes of protest rallies and that kind of thing.
Yes, well, my colleague has given us a lot of great detail and information about the current situation. And, of course, we have to look at the whole context of this. For over 100 years now, since the October Revolution in Russia, the Americans have been trying to interfere in the politics of Russia. We've seen that over the 20th century. We've seen it during the Cold War, where the Soviet Union and America were at loggerheads militarily in countries like Angola, in Cuba, and Vietnam, and, of course, more recently in Syria. And what we have here is American hegemony trying to influence its power. It uses cultural imperialism, it uses politics, economics, and, of course, military ventures. So there's no surprise that the Americans are interfering with the situation in Russia any more than it is that the Russia interferes with the politics of America. So we have here two superpowers who are at loggerheads, and this is part of that pattern. What we're seeing, of course, which is very different over the past 100 years, is the emergence of China. So whatever happens internally in Russia and in America will be determined ultimately by where China lays its allegiances. Of course, we've had several U.S. presidents, Trump, Obama, Bush, and Biden. They continue the same policy because whoever's in charge in America, the CIA and the FBI, are still involved in trying to influence Russian politics at every single level. So this is a small, relatively small incident in that history of conflict between Russia and America. And I think this is going to continue and there'll be no change until there's been some shift in global politics. And I think that's going to come from China.
Okay, appreciate your comments and contribution. Marina Kortanova, our correspondent journalist from Moscow, and Kenneth Thurr, lecturer with Coventry University out of London. Thank you for staying tuned. Let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. The United States has reaffirmed its commitment to deepening ties with Taiwan amid rising tension between the self-ruled island and China. The U.S. State Department says Washington will continue to help Taipei maintain sufficient self-defense capability. Spokesman Ned Price also urged China to stop pressuring Taiwan and instead engage in meaningful dialogue with the officials there. Meanwhile, the U.S. military says an aircraft carrier group led by USS Theodore Roosevelt has entered the South China Sea, and that after Taiwan reported an incursion by Chinese warplanes into its air defense identification zone. Beijing is critical of Washington's boosting of ties with the island, which it views as part of its territory. The Venezuelan president says that he's willing to turn the page with the U.S. under President Joe Biden after years of tensions with the previous administration. Nicolas Maduro called for a new path in his country's relations with Washington based on mutual respect, dialogue, communication, and understanding. The Trump administration had slapped numerous rounds of sanctions on Venezuela, including an oil embargo in 2019, to overthrow the Maduro government. Caracas broke diplomatic ties with Washington in 2019 when the U.S. government recognized opposition leader Juan Guaido as the Venezuelan interim president. The United Nations Refugee Agency has expressed concerns about a resurgence of violence in Sudan's Darfur region that has caused a fresh flow of refugees to neighboring Chad. The UNHCR says the tribal clashes have killed at least 250 people, displacing more than 100,000 others. Some 3,500 of the refugees, most of them women and children, have fled to Chad, where they are sheltering under the trees without access to basic services. The fighting in Darfur has already spread to the western and southern parts of the region. The violence is a major test for the Sudanese government following the pullback of the UN and the African Union peacekeepers from the region earlier this month. That brings us to the end of this news broadcast.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to Aperture. We follow Javad, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the desert regions in South Khorasan province, an area of vast desert, sand dunes, and aridness as far as the eye can see. But amid what looks like arid wasteland, at first are wonderful and amazing surprises, including canyons, freshwater springs, and traces of past civilizations.
But perhaps what is even more amazing, the next part of the program, is that this dry, arid land yields the world's most coveted spice and Iran's prized red gold, saffron.
I leave behind the ruins of Dihuk and its beautiful architecture for my main destination, which is the terraced saffron farms of Esfandiar, a patchwork of little farms that demands the attention of any visitor. The name Esfandiar was derived from the word Espand, or wild root plants that grow in abundance in and around this village. In the spring season, these perennial plants make the mountains surrounding Esfandiar all the more beautiful. In my opinion, this village is a masterpiece, home to many and varied beauties in and around it. The people of Esfandiar are kind, faithful, and hardworking. Farming is the main occupation of the people living in this part of the country, and their main produce is Iran's famed red gold, that is, saffron. The fragrant, vivid crimson threads are known by almost everybody around the world, and has forever been the world's most expensive spice. In the words of researchers, the history of saffron goes back thousands of years. Iran was the first place where these beautiful flowers were planted. And after Iran's neighboring countries such as India, Syria, and Lebanon found out about it, it was also planted in Greece for the first time. The word zafaran is the Arabicized version of the word zarparan, meaning a flower with petals of gold. Saffron threads are plucked from the flower saffron crocus and used mainly as a seasoning and coloring agent in food. Historically, saffron has been among the most expensive spices in the world. Harvesting saffron is so labor-intensive. Every 150,000 crocus flowers that weigh approximately 75 kilos yields a meager 1 kilo of this sought-after spice. The crocus bulb grows multiple flowers for several years, but after that, the number of its buds decreases by the year. Still, there have been instances where 30-year-old bulbs bloomed too. Around the world, saffron is used as food seasoning, medicine, dyeing agent, and fragrance. At the moment, Iran is the world's biggest producer of saffron, accounting for 90% of the world's production. Saffron has been used as a coloring agent for 50,000 years. Signs of that application have been discovered in drawings found in caves in Iraq and across the Achaemenid Persian Empire. Sumerians used it as medicine and for making certain potions. Iran's South Khorasan province is the main producer of saffron in the country. The reason I've chosen Esfandiar is the many other stunning sights to see apart from the beautiful saffron farms, the beautiful pomegranate, fig, and almond gardens. The lofty mountains behind the village reaching to the skies, the vast terraced saffron farms, and a very hospitable people who are a valuable asset for Iran. Add to that the beautiful ancient village of Esfandiar that has lain uninhabited for around 30 years for fear of earthquakes. Thank you. 12 beauties have turned Esfandiar into a peerless little paradise in the heart of the desert. I'm overjoyed at the knowledge that the village has maintained its original shape, everything from the architecture to the farmlands. Thanks to my good friend Abbas Amiri, a village council member and a schoolteacher, and the other responsible inhabitants of the village, no one is allowed to make even the smallest changes to the architecture of the buildings in the village and of those nearby. I hope that the authorities of the Cultural Heritage Organization and the responsible villagers living here will join forces in preserving and renovating the unique architecture of the buildings in Esfandiar, give local and foreign tourists a chance to relish in such a beautiful bucolic environment, and leave a precious legacy for posterity. Additionally, a move like that will help the country's tourism industry to thrive and create jobs for the locals, provided that not a single modern structure is built in this area, and the landscape is clear of paved roads, power posts, and other eyesores. I spend the whole day walking around in the mountains surrounding Esfandiar and taking beautiful photos of the village from different angles. I'm supposed to accompany my good friend Amir, a village council member and high school teacher, and his kindly wife to a saffron farm. I want to see up close how they and other villagers pick the saffron threads. It's freezing. It's 6:30 in the morning and most of the villagers have already sat down in a squatting position on their farms picking saffron-bearing flowers. I really didn't want to get out of my comfortable bed and come out here in this biting cold and dry weather. But the best time to pick those flowers and to see the farmers at work is the very early cold hours of morning. Apparently, it has to be cold and it should still be dark when they start picking the flowers. I better get going. Very cold, very. It is mid-fall and the best time to harvest the saffron. The cold early morning fall weather in the desert is ice cold. Time is of the essence for these saffron farmers, so they have to make the best use of the time they have. From the day when the first saffron crocuses burst into flower, the farmers have around 15 days to pick all of them. Therefore, they cannot wake up anytime they want and go to work anytime they please. There is a certain time during all those 15 days at which the farmers can pick the flowers, and that is only the early morning hours. All the villagers, men and women, young and old, lend a helping hand on the farm during this period. It takes a certain degree of skill to pick the flowers, and the older folks of Esfandiar are master pickers, hands down. If you leave those flowers under the sun for too long after they have bloomed, your saffron is going to lose most of its original aroma and taste. It diminishes the quality of your saffron, as if the aroma of the saffron gets released into the air and disappears forever. That's what I'm told. You have to pick the buds with the longest stems, and you have to do it fast. There is no alternative to the human hand when it comes to picking these flowers. No machines, no automatons, no nothing. The men and women of the village spend hours squatting or doubling down while picking the flowers. The cold weather and the time crunch on the one hand, and the pressure on the farmers' knees and backs on the other, make the job ever more difficult. The tips of the fingers tingle from the bitter cold, and nagging pain starts to be felt in the knees and back. The work is agonizing and toilsome. Desert dwellers are tough human beings, and do not easily give up in the face of the difficulties presented to them by life. These people's entire being is made up of hope and love of life. They are eternally grateful to God, even when doing the most difficult of work. The young people, too, hum local songs as they work. After spending only a couple of hours with Amir and his family on their farm, I'm completely worn out. The pain in my back and knees is excruciating, but I feel great, because during those 3 hours, I got to see firsthand what these hard-working people go through. I can feel their pain. But there's something that upsets me and all of Iran's saffron farmers. Unfortunately, the farmers do the lion's share of the work in producing saffron. A case in point is the back-breaking harvesting process. But it's the middleman who stands to make most of the profit. That's an issue that calls for proper management and careful planning. The farmers need help to cash in on the result of their hard work, to make a profit that makes it all worth their while. Another big problem is a lack of proper, internationally interesting packaging industry in Iran for exporting saffron. A country like Spain is making the best of this opportunity. It buys Iran's high-quality saffron at a very low price, puts it in beautiful, modern packaging, and re-exports it to other countries in its own name and at a much higher price. The margin of profit is staggering, and that's what the farmers here have been complaining about. I am depressed after watching the farmers work so hard and hearing out their problems, but Amir has a present for me to cheer me up. To refresh themselves and shake off the cold after the working hours, the farmers get together somewhere next to their farms and brew themselves some fresh tea laced with fresh saffron in a pot on fire made from dry sticks. Locals here believe that saffron tea cheers you up. It makes you laugh. It helps freshen you up. But for someone like me, the question that comes to mind is, how can you not be happy when you hang around with such hardworking, kind, pure souls? How can you sit down with these folks, sip saffron tea with them, and not be filled with joy? The fact is that even without this tea, saffron tea I mean, you get filled with peace and happiness when you hang around with people who spend all day, from morning till evening, doing back-breaking work. Cheers. After imbibing that delicious saffron-flavored tea one sip at a time, I decide to sit down with one of the elders of Esfandiar, and that is none other than Mr. Danai. He tells me about the desert people's frugal existence, about their simple lifestyle, about the tough days of famine many years ago, and the perseverance and resilience of his fellow villagers in the face of the vicissitudes of life. The farmers don't have any time to waste. Therefore, after picking the flowers, they usually sit down together and start the next phase of saffron production, which is plucking the stigmas from the flowers. That's why I believe those who live in deserts or near them are very patient people. See for yourself. Take a look around. It took a lot of patience for them to turn this steep surface into a terraced farmland. Then, with a lot of hardship, they planted the saffron bulbs in it, spent months attending to them and waiting for them to yield. As far as I know, saffron crocuses bloom once a year. It takes a lot of elbow grease to cultivate them. They don't need much water, but still growing them is no walk in the park. Everything about saffron requires a lot of hard work and patience. That's why I've come to believe that desert dwellers are very stoic. Whatever they do calls for a lot of patience, and if they aren't patient, things won't happen. They won't prosper. The pain Mr. Amiri has in his knees and back is a pain that everybody here shares. All these people work really hard on these farms. And as I say, those living in desert climates are super patient human beings. Being in their company gives you the kind of peace that defies description. The last stage in the production of saffron involves spreading the stigmas on a proper surface and leaving them to dry. And that's a job that has to be done with a lot of care and skill. Otherwise, quality of the end product will be impacted. In the end, the middlemen come to the villages, buy the dried saffron from the farmers, and sell it at staggering prices after proper packaging. I have high hopes for this beautiful village to be reconstructed and renovated. I hope that on my next trip to Esfandiyar, I see many tourists here. There aren't many places on Earth that share the same natural, architectural, agricultural, and anthropological variety as Esfandiyar's. But unfortunately, those beautiful houses you see behind me, although they used to be people's homes one day, now lay in ruins. No one is paying adequate attention to all the historical, cultural, and architectural beauties of our beloved country. I'm sure each one of those houses in this beautiful mountainous region, with all these vast terraced saffron farms and its beautiful gardens, not to mention its very hospitable residents, I'm sure if they are renovated, they can act as hotels in this region to accommodate tourists coming from other countries and, of course, local tourists traveling to this region. They can become beautiful hotels offering peaceful moments to those staying at them. My trip to South Khorasan has come to an end. I'm leaving with beautiful memories and valuable knowledge of this region of Iran. Before setting out for this part of the country from the capital city, I wouldn't even dream of such spectacular scenery and such kind human beings. I traveled to this area to see the saffron crocuses growing in the desert. I found the beauties of South Khorasan as a treasure trove, each of which is as beautiful as Iran's famed saffron. All this area needs to turn it into a major tourist attraction is proper attention and management on the part of government officials. And all that is possible if the traditional lifestyle of the folks living here does not undergo any radical changes, and provided the untouched scenery in these areas is not despoiled by modern residential and industrial structures. The beautiful face of deserts and the wilderness, the sand dunes and mountains, the animal and plant species living in deserts, an unpolluted blue sky, clean air, beautiful, vacant yet livable villages, the farms and gardens of the area, and on top of them all, the genuine and hospitable people with a rich culture. Each and every one of them is as precious as the saffron produced in the desert of South Khorasan. All I wish for is for all these assets to be preserved and protected for future generations.
Perhaps next time you enjoy another Persian dish with the exquisite scent of saffron, you will remember the terraced saffron farms of Esfandiyar and the kind and hard-working farmers who plant the little purple flowers and harvest strands of red gold. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. But before we go, remember you can contact us either through email, Facebook, or Twitter. Goodbye for now.
A letter for you.
And this is a letter written by the leader of the Muslim Ummah.
Special program on the message of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei to the youth in Europe and North America.
Open the windows! Let the world hear!
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. I am Muzaffar Abbas Haider.
I am Murtaza Razavi.
And I am Ali Shah.
We're here to discuss today...
A letter for you.
From
the Supreme Leader of Iran, Mr. Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Mm-hmm. Which has been catching a lot of attention.
This letter is stirring up a lot of controversy, and people are throwing opinions left, right, and centre all over the internet. You can just Google it, and you can find out a lot about what's going on. It's changed a lot of perspectives because it's not every day that you see a Middle Eastern leader propagating free thought. And that's exactly what Ayatollah Khamenei is doing in the letter. Unless you disagree with me, Editor Zarizwi. One of the scholars here mentioned just recently to myself that the West has always had a kind of ill feeling towards Islam, towards religion in general. And this ill feeling has manifested itself through media and politics and the youth. Now, the youth are the ones who Ayatollah Khamenei is addressing in the letter. Now, Irtizo, how do you feel? Do you feel that that's an accurate presentation of the West's feelings towards religion?
The West's feeling towards religion is both, man. I mean, like, sometimes you feel that if you believe in God, then you're laughed at. Mm-hmm. And you're, like, outdated. You're kind of naive, stupid.
Is it like that in Scotland?
Like you believe in a fairy tale and so on and so forth. However, there are some people with, if you like, just do a Google search. The conversion to religion, specifically Islam, is on the rise.
Mm.
Why? There's one thing that a teacher told me.
Mm.
That he's like, basically, this is his opinion. And he's like, after you've gone after all the happiness and the materialistic stuff that the world can offer.
The fast
money,
cars, the food.
Everything.
The
money, women,
Ali.
Food. Everything. Like, you go after that, the holidays, the boats.
What do you mean,
like,
Ali?
Like, mountains, whatever. You still have that empty hole that you need to fill up.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's like a reason why people are coming towards religion or looking towards some type of faith or, I don't know, belief.
Ayatollah Khamenei says in the letter, many attempts have been made over the past two decades, almost since the disintegration of the Soviet Union, to place this great religion in the seat of a horrifying enemy.
Yeah.
So in many ways, religion, and Islam, has been like...
It's demonized. Not the first time. I mean, before Islam, who was it? It was the Jews.
The Jews?
Yeah. Before Islam, it was like...
In the Nazi Germany.
Yeah. It was like anti-Semitism and like...
In fact, there was a lot of anti-Semitism back in those days in America and even England.
America, England. And then before that, or maybe after that...
In the Crusades.
It was Crusades. Not even that. Like, what's it called? Slavery to the Black Brothers from Africa. I mean, the slave trade, basically. That's what I was looking for, the slave trade.
So, like, throughout history, there's always been this demonization
of something. I mean, if you go back to just primary stage, in school, bullies.
Uh-huh.
I think it's just something that happens within life, that you have to look at something and be like, that is different to me, I am going to hate it.
Uh-huh. And Ali, well, what's your take on this?
About the youth in Scotland, yeah?
Yeah. I mean... do the youth in Scotland, I mean, I'm talking about the non-Muslim youth, do they see Islam as this big, terrifying enemy?
The reason is that the youth in Scotland are, they've never, ever studied Islam. Never.
Oh.
So okay. It's like...
Really?
Never.
Like, it's not even a syllabus in the school?
No.
It's not a syllabus in Kent either, by the way.
There's no
really?
Syllabus. In no school, there's no Islam.
In that sense, London is very, very different
because
obviously you have these different religious groups.
So no syllabus,
London,
nothing.
In England, nobody cares about Islam. Nobody cares about Hinduism. No, nobody cares about religion. Nobody cares.
If you give the Quran in English translation to a brother, he's going to open the Quran and it's going to say, kill the disbelievers when you see them. Now, when a person reads that without the meaning or without the context of that verse, he's going to think this religion is
barbaric.
Nothing but terror.
Hmm.
So most of the youth in Scotland, when they hear about Islam, all they think about is bombs and Daesh.
Basically what the media shows them.
Whatever the media shows them, they believe it.
It's interesting what you were saying earlier about the victimization of Jews throughout history and the victimization of black people. I mean, just before the...
And then the Aborigines, and then... You can go on for ages.
You can make a long list.
Aborigines and,
unless I'm very much mistaken, it's always more than you'd normally been... the Western imperialists who have done that throughout history.
To be honest, like,
I'm thinking about other empires that have existed. They didn't seem to do as much damage.
Other empires back in the day, I guess Romans, Genghis Khan, like, they were barbaric people. They, rip your guys' limbs off.
Uh-huh.
But in terms of the systematic
victimization
and, like, I can't find the word at the moment. Just completely obliterating, like,
I think back then they used to kill people, but now it's like a cold, like, kind of.
Now it's become a kind of psychological hatred,
brainwash.
Like. See, and the thing is that, like, a lot of Muslims that I've spoken to in the West, they feel as if, like, for instance, the West has done this themselves, but now they're pushing it, they're tarnishing, they're pasting it upon Islam and saying, Islam's like that as well.
Yeah.
Islam's actually even worse than us. So, okay, fine, we've made these mistakes, but we've changed. These people have been like that and they're still like that. Look.
Mm-hmm. The media now. Now, I mean, we're in the 21st century now. The media has a huge role to play in this. And I just wanted to ask a question. Do you know anything about King Kong? The famous movie about the...
It was one of my favourite movies.
Your favourite movie was King Kong?
I mean, it was one of them. I have many, 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 many
What's
movies.
Wrong with you?
Well, King Kong is all right, bro.
What do you like about King Kong?
That's really weird.
He's strong.
He's strong?
Yeah.
He's a gorilla, man.
So?
Were you crying when he got killed?
Maybe.
King Kong, now, this is a very old film. It goes back to the 50s, I think.
Oh, you're talking about the old one.
The very old one. The reason this character, King Kong, was invented was because at the time, America wanted to invade Viet Cong.
Oh.
It needed a way to victimize those people. So propaganda. If you have a big, bad, scary monster on the screen called King Kong...
Propaganda.
There you go. You have automatically sent messages to the minds of the public, making them think, that there's a big, bad monster that we need to go and destroy.
But can this...
Somewhere in a jungle somewhere.
But can this not be argued also that this letter, A Letter For You, is propaganda? But however...
Mm-hmm.
My personal opinion, not that you might care, you might not... That
I never care, it is.
Thank you.
I care though.
We'll edit that out. Don't worry. Continue. And basically, this letter for you is propaganda. You can say it's propaganda. Let's just say that.
Okay.
But the bulk of what it's saying, there's nothing bad to it at all.
Yeah.
All it is saying, like, when you strip everything else away, strip away it from the Supreme Leader, strip away the religion, strip away the East, strip away everything.
Yeah.
What it's saying is, like from VT Veterans Today, that all it is saying is, think for yourself.
Yeah.
I don't think that's bad at all.
I have to say this, that lots of people are arguing that it's just another political tool. It's just another way of doing propaganda. Mm. He's basically just trying to bring youth in the West towards Islam. But now this is what... This is the interesting point. In the letter, Ayatollah Khamenei says the histories of the United States and Europe are ashamed of slavery, that slavery embarrassed by the colonial period and chagrined at the oppression of people of color and non-Christians. Your researchers, i.e., the researchers of the West, and historians are deeply ashamed of the bloodsheds wrought in the name of religion between the Catholics and Protestants, or in the name of nationality and ethnicity during the First and Second World Wars. This approach is admirable. So Ayatollah Khamenei in this letter is saying to be ashamed of that history is admirable. Now, he says he's just mentioning a fraction of a long list of things which have gone pear-shaped throughout history, which America or the West has been behind. And the interesting thing about this is he's saying, why is it that attempts are made to prevent public awareness regarding an important issue such as the treatment of Islamic culture and thought?
And this is the Supreme Leader.
So he's saying, why is it, like, he's just asking the youth to think, why is it that America has turned its attention, well, predominantly America, but other nations as well, have turned their attention towards Islam? Why is it that they're victimizing Islam now? You know, in the past, it might have been Viet Cong, it might have been the black people, the Jews, whoever. But why is it Islam now? And I think the message here is just wake up now before something bad happens. Ali, what's your take on this?
I completely agree with you, brother. It's always been a religion or a nation. And at this time, it is Islam.
Hmm.
And it's really surprising because we bring nothing but the peace. Oh. Our religion it does not tell us to blow ourselves up or do bombs like the West, bro.
Yeah.
What is your main thing they say about us?
That we're terrorists. That we're gonna blow stuff all about up.
Yeah, but then, but then it can be argued, bro. Like when you look at the news and you see a guy with a big beard chopping off another guy's head and saying kafir and shouting Allahu Akbar, like they can be like, how can you blame us? Look at yourself in Iraq.
Mm.
Look what's happening. Like we know ourselves. Okay, fine. That's not what Islam preaches.
Yeah.
But for the West, for the youth, for the people who don't know because they're not Muslims.
Yeah, Islam is completely being victimized.
It's completely being victimized.
I can see what you're saying, though. Like some of it is,
but
is the Muslims' fault? Can we really say that? I mean,
if you look what the Muslims have in the world, and then when the West want to attain those resources, maybe they, like some of the Muslim countries are giving their will.
Uh-huh.
They're having partnership with the West.
Yeah.
But then if you look at Iran, they're not willing to shake hands with the West or with the government.
I mean, no, they're willing to shake hands with the West.
No, but they're not willing to like, you know what I mean? They're not willing to,
but they're not willing
exchange
to
change
like
their beliefs and their like will to them.
Yeah.
Like sell themselves.
Saudi Arabia, for example.
Uh-huh.
It can be argued that that is the center of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Because Mecca is there and all the holy sites, the Prophet's buried there. The Prophet was from there. The Prophet started his mission from there.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be argued very strongly that is the center of the religion.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you see the people in charge, the kings, the monarchy, and all that, first of all, the Prophet never preached like hierarchy in terms of kingship.
Monarchy.
He abolished kingship.
Yeah.
He abolished that completely. That's one big point.
Uh-huh.
I never.
One point that I would like to raise is that the propaganda, although it is from the West as well, it can also be argued that it's coming from the Middle East also.
Yeah.
A recent statistic showed that there are quite a few German youths who are turning to Daesh. Now,
Daesh is what?
Daesh is ISIS.
Okay.
In the Middle East, ISIS is known as Daesh. Now, that would mean that the propaganda is coming from both sides. It's not just coming from the West. It's coming from the East as well. On the one hand, you have these people victimizing Islam. On the other hand, you have...
Oh, my God. That's an
easy question.
I just had a brainwave.
Who are giving the wrong impression of Islam.
No, I just had a brainwave. Like, now this letter makes complete sense to me. Like you just said it.
Uh-huh.
From the East, all this stuff is coming about whatever.
Yeah, go blow yourself up.
Like sectarianism, whatever. All this stuff is coming.
Yeah.
And this, funny enough, the Supreme Leader of Iran has talked against sectarianism so much.
Yes.
So maybe, and then from the West, he's got bombardment saying that he's a bad man. Maybe this is the Supreme Leader really saying, clearly, think for yourself now.
Yeah.
You can see the scale. You can see these people hate me. You can see these, my the own Muslims also hate me. They really. Now, youth, think for yourself.
He's really in the middle of these two extreme sides here. Like, one side is completely wanting to destroy Islam.
The
other one
is
destroying Islam from the inside. I mean, that makes perfect sense here. That's actually really true. Now, in the letter, Ayatollah Khamenei says, you know well that that humiliation and spreading hatred and illusionary fear of the other have been the common base of all those oppressive profiteers. Ayatollah Khamenei is basically saying, look, the West always creates this other, and this other is apparent, it's there.
Yeah.
And it does this because it's the perfect model for victimizing something, perhaps invading, perhaps attacking in whatever way, whether it's psychological, whether it's military. He also says in the letter, now I would like to ask yourself why the old policy of spreading phobia and hatred has targeted Islam and Muslims with an unprecedented intensity. Hence, my first request is study and research the incentives behind this widespread tarnishing of the image of Islam. And as we've discussed, it's coming from both sides. It's coming from outside of Islam and it's coming from within Islam.
Yeah.
And poor old Ayatollah Khamenei is...
Be free.
To the youths out there, we would like to just very quickly say...
Be free.
Be free.
Freedom is the way.
And inshallah, we'll see you next time on A Letter For You. And we hope...
From the Supreme Leader of Iran.
Ciao.
A letter for you.
And this is a letter written by the leader of the Muslim Ummah.
Special program on the message of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei to the youth in Europe and North America.
What you heard
was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.